Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and all the podcasts here at WFYI are available on Spotify. In a little bit, I'm going to play my interview with Food Network personality, chef, podcaster, and all-around good guy Simon Majumdar in a little bit to talk about the legacy of Terry Jones of Monty Python fame. He died earlier this week. But first, before we get to that, I do want to mention, we're in the January movie time here at your favorite multiplex as well as at the Art House. But opening this week, we have The Turning and The Gentleman, the Guy Ritchie returning to crime comedies with a kind of a Red Bull pace to him. But opening in Indy, finally, at Glendale, the Glendale Cinema, I'm hoping it gets some more screens. But it's the animated film that's up for Best Animated Feature, the Academy Awards, of the film I Lost My Body. And it's a French animated film about a severed hand escaping its captivity and looking for the body that it was connected to. And so imagine if Thing from the Addams Family had an adventure, and it has that feel to it. But it also cross pollinates with the man who's lost the hand and what he was going through. It's different. This year's nominees for Best Animated Feature aren't particularly strong, although I did like Toy Story 4, but this one's probably the most original. So, and what I love about this category is there's usually one or two that come out of nowhere. It's not just Disney, Pixar, or something from the United States or the UK for that matter. So, it's fine for little ones. It's a little dark because it does deal with a severed hand, but it also has a boy-girl relationship that's it's a little squirm-inducing, but it's all right. So look for I Lost My Body. I don't know if it's available on streaming, but it is playing at Glendale. And, of course, a bigger screen is better than your screen, no matter how big your screen is. So go check that out, I Lost My Body. And it's interesting that I mentioned the Addams Family because the animated version of the Addams Family with Charlize Theron, Oscar Isaacs, and others is now out on Blu-ray and DVD, as is Zombieland Devil Tap. Did anybody ask for a sequel to Zombieland except for the cast? Right. And also, getting a boost, Pain and Glory. This is the film that Antonio Banderas earned a Best Actor nomination, and that will get some more eyes on that film because of that. So congrats. I want to get to a little bit of I'm trying to catch up on some films that have been sent to me. A fascinating double feature from Fritz Lang. Fritz Lang did two films and shot on location in India. The Tiger of Eskenapur, and The Indian Tomb. And according to some reports, this was an early influence for Raiders of the Lost Ark for young Steven Spielberg, as I believe somebody referred to it, a clear precursor to the Indiana Jones series. It's about a German architect who goes to India to work on a new project and for a Maharaja. And while he is working there, he falls for an exotic dancer played by Deborah Padgett. Yes, Hollywood. So you have a mostly German, a little Swiss, and some an American actor involved. And but she is supposed to be set up for marriage with somebody else, and this leads to some tension. It's a two-parter. Fritz Lang, again, shot this in 1958 and released in 59, but wanted to make a cliffhanger, and he does. It's an all, like I said, mostly German cast set in India. So for you young folks out there, yes, it's not just the United States, but yes, there's some brown face going on with German actors posing as Asian Indians. And of course, Deborah Padgett. But for a 50s action melodrama, it's still pretty good. And it's Fritz Lang, who hasn't lost his touch behind a camera. This was one of the last things he did near the end of his life, this West German French Italian adventure film. The thing that cracks me up about it is, despite the really beautiful locations of India, and then you have some decent set pieces, and they said the acting's not bad. Your hero is a moving, active chin. Deborah Padgett is quite alluring as the temple dancer Sita. But there is a moment that I love from old movies where you have the hero is thrown into the tiger pit, and you have the upper level where the tiger is, actual tiger. And then you have separate footage shot elsewhere in another day of our hero. And then eventually you're ready for the tiger to leap onto the human. And there is a moment, because nobody expected these in 1959 to be on videotape or DVD or streaming, but you have the moment of the tiger leaping at the human. And in this case, it was, you could see a string and a tiger doll being sent down a chute with the string, and then it lands. And then you get a quick close-up of actual tiger after it's been sliced by the hero. And I remember saying to my daughter, a B-movie wouldn't have the string. They would just throw a plush tiger out, and that would be that. The film's about an hour and 40 minutes, and deliberately ends on a cliffhanger note, and then you get bursting onto the screen the German words, basically, see the Indian tomb, go see the sequel, find out how they'll survive. So kind of a bold to do an hour and 40 minute cliffhanger. This is, you know, and I believe the serials back in the old days were 10 to 30 minutes, depending on the serial. So anyway, if you're into old school action adventure, it's pretty decent. And if you can get past Germans playing Indians, well, that's another discussion for another time. But yeah, the Tiger of Eshnapur and the Indian Tomb. Now, the film also has some commentary tracks, which I need to get to, but also a really cool documentary about Deborah Padgett. She was a contract player at Fox. She was one of those that she was a star, but it wasn't Marilyn Monroe level, wasn't Audrey Hepburn level, but she did a number of films, everything from because she had dark complected skin, a lot of Indians and gypsies and Italians, and yes, she wound up in doing Love Me Tender, Elvis's first film, and was out of the business by the 60s, got out, but really an interesting look at the casting process and the studio system back in the 40s and 50s. And a really nice insight on Deborah Padgett. And yes, guys, the dance scene in the Indian tomb it's worth renting. So yeah, that was put out by Film Movement Classics. Also out is we see films to hopefully discover new things from MVD Visual, a documentary called Voice of the Eagle, The Enigma of Robby Basho. This was an American acoustic guitarist, little folk, little new agey. Honestly, I had to say I didn't know of Robbie's work before watching this, but a really cool look at somebody for Robby, the music was more than just music. It was his religion. It was his passion. It was his soul. And we get talking heads like Pete Townsend and Country Joe of Country Joe and the Fish talking about his influence, where it was you had influences in blues, folk, Asian music, Indian music, and it all wrapped together. And he was one of those, apparently, was just a little too out there compared to the other acoustic artists and folk artists in the day. Recorded for everybody from Vanguard to Wyndham Hill. So was one of the early precursors of the kind of new age music, or Hearts of Space, or Echoes, those type of programs. There's quite a number of songs of his with footage of the country and the mountains and the desert and the ocean and the sky. So this is also a relaxing documentary at times. Had an odd and random death. He had a freak accident at a chiropractor and had the neck snapped, and it went bad, I should say. But and talked about how his albums didn't sell that well, but were highly praised. One of these artists constantly looking for his audience. And the final line in the documentary was a guitar peer who said, "Sometimes you have to die first." And sadly, that's the case with Robbie Basho. But it's new for me, standard filmmaking, but interesting music. And I love these stories where the art is their life. And look for, from MVD Visual, Voice of the Eagle, The Enigma of Robbie Basho. We'll get to my interview with Simon in a little bit, but first, at IU Cinema, depending on when you listen to this, Friday, January 24th at 7 o'clock, Kevin Smith's Mallrats, and at 10 o'clock, Tigers Are Not Afraid. Sunday, the 25th at 4 o'clock, Kurosawa's masterpiece, Yojimbo, and at 7 o'clock, Tigers Are Not Afraid. Sunday, the 26th, The Fake Case at 1 o'clock, at 4 o'clock, Jim Jarmusch's Mystery Train. Monday, the 27th at 7 o'clock, Cunningham 3D. Thursday, the 30th, Jim Jarmusch and Carter Logan will be in town. That event is sold out. Standby only for Jim Jarmusch on Friday, the 31st at 4 p.m. Sold out at 7 o'clock, his film Dead Man. At 11 o'clock, or 10 o'clock, Jim Jarmusch will be present for the screening of The Limits of Control from 2009. Saturday, February 1st at 4 o'clock from 1982, The Secret of Nim, and at 7 o'clock, Little Forest. Sunday, February 2nd at 1 o'clock, Sunset Boulevard at 1, Jim Jarmusch's Patterson at 4 o'clock. Those are all happening at IU Cinema. At the Historic Artcraft Theater in Franklin on the 24th and 25th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. Just enough time for them to flip it over because the film's that long. February 6th at 6:30, Friday and Saturday, a free event, the Inseparable Film Tour. See five original films about Indiana created by five award-winning Indiana filmmakers. And that is sponsored by Indiana Humanities on February 6th and 7th. That's a Friday and Saturday at 6:30. 1:30 p.m. Thursday, February 13th. A free showing of Sabrina for those 55 or over, courtesy of Swartz Family Community Mortuary. And then February 14th and 15th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., and this is the original Sabrina, over at the Artcraft Theater, Pretty Woman on February 21st. And on Saturday, February 22nd at 2 o'clock, my top film of 2019, the Aretha Franklin concert documentary, Amazing Grace, will be shown at the Artcraft Theater. Now, at the Vogue, they've been doing movies on Monday nights, and Monday the 27th at 8 p.m., Ridley Scott's Alien. On Monday, February 3rd, Stand By Me at 8 o'clock. On Monday the 10th at 8 o'clock, Dirty Dancing. And I think there's that. Oh, and then February 24th at 8 o'clock, The Shawshank Redemption. All of those happening at the Vogue. And then at the Buskirk Chumley Theater in Bloomington on Saturday the 25th at 6:45, the Telling Our Story screening. And then at 7:30 p.m. on the 25th, The Neverending Story. And then Friday, January 31st at 7:30 p.m., Monica and McKenna, this is for you. Friday, January 31st at the Buskirk Chumley Theater at 7:30 p.m., they're showing Labyrinth. Give my best to the Goblin King. And then Sunday the 2nd at 2 and 4:15 p.m., as a part of the Writer Film Series, they're going to be showing the Oscar Shorts Film Festival. So the nominated short films this year will be playing in Bloomington on Sunday, February 2nd. So Terry Jones passed away. A member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, was the director of The Holy Grail, Life of Brian, The Meaning of Life. He also directed Personal Services, Eric the Viking. In my interview with Simon, which you'll hear in a minute, I misspoke. The title from 1996 is Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. Absolutely Anything, which is I saw a write-up of this in the My World of Flops website. Haven't watched it yet. A little scared. But a writer. He also co-wrote Labyrinth and appeared in a lot of stuff on TV and documentaries. And the second of the Python clan to die. Of course, Graham Chapman died when I was in college in 1989. Monty Python has meant a lot to me, as it has to a lot of you. And he will be missed. And as John Cleese wrote on his Twitter page, two down, four to go. John Cleese can write that. So with that in mind, hopefully you'll check out some Python over the weekend, whether it's the TV series or the film or any of the other projects he's worked on. But on Friday, I got to speak with Simon Majumdar. You know him from Food Network. He also has a really cool podcast called Eat My Globe. And I got to talk to Simon about Terry Jones's legacy as well as some other things. Here we go. Simon, to start with, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the name Terry Jones?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind with me is just my personal encounters with him. I was very fortunate when I worked in publishing for Penguin Books that Terry actually wrote a number of children's history books. And a lot of people will know him for his, you know, obviously his comedy and his influence on that, but they won't necessarily know that he was a real historian, and he made television shows and wrote books about history too. Very good if you ever get a chance to watch them. Very funny and quite Python-esque in the way they present history. So I just remember seeing him wandering around the corridors of the Penguin offices, kind of often looking a bit bemused because he didn't know where he was going, in a very Terry Jones way. And just being a very kind, very charming, very funny, nice guy to everyone, very down-to-earth. And always a great joy to be in his company. So I think my first thoughts are a personal one. But after that, I just think his influence on not just British comedy, but worldwide comedy, there aren't many people who are going to be quite that high up, I think, who have influenced so many people.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. But since you mentioned the children's books that he did and that they were Python-esque, can you give an example? Because I think the earlier you can introduce kids to Monty Python's type of humor, I think that we're all the better for it.
Gosh, well, yeah, he did. And I know if you think about the books and stuff that's around now that kids seem to love, that the kind of horrible histories and that kind of thing, which I don't know if you know too much about those series. He kind of liked that, so he always went into kind of the kind of dirty side of things, as it was. He would do books about some of the foul jobs in medieval times. He actually wrote one called Medieval Lives, which was a very, very good book. And then he wrote stuff about Chaucer, and he just loved that period. He particularly loved the medieval period. And I think if you see things like, obviously, Holy Grail, you see that. But he looked at it with a sense of enthusiasm and exuberance. And he knew, you know, I have a friend with a young son now, 9, and he loves watching all of these and reading the books, because that kind of grubbiness of medieval life is something I think kids really kind of turn to. And also what people forget is just before they started Python, the teams worked on two shows separately. They did one called Do Not Adjust Your Set, yep, which was people like Eric Idle. And then on the other side, they had one called The Complete and Utter History of Britain. I think they found them all, and they might all be on YouTube, or go watch them. They're all in black and white, and they were kind of very Python-esque in their approach. They would have, you know, someone doing a report, like a war correspondent, but from a medieval battle, and they would do it in the kind of present-day style and have the fights there and talk to them and interview them, and it was all very kind of funny. And it was from those two shows that they kind of connected with each other and then formed the kind of Python-esque group. So they're all on, you know, YouTube, as I said, go and find them because they're very funny. The humor stands up very well. And Terry Jones was at the heart of that. So I think that was his, I think outside of his kind of just pure comedy, I think he was really, really loved that period of history.
And I'm going through his filmography, and his, now that you mentioned the children's books, I've forgotten that he had directed a film version of Frog and Toad, which makes a lot more sense now.
Absolutely. I mean, he loved, again, those stories. I think at heart he was just a really great storyteller. And he was a really good director as well. I mean, I think, again, that's the thing that people forget. And the other side of it, of course, that I think about all the time is, and this is kind of a very British thing, which I think throws a lot of Americans, was just his complete love of dressing up in drag and those shows. And I think a lot of people who think of Python will, of course, they'll think of him playing what was, in fact, an affectionate kind of tribute to his mum, who
yes.
was a particularly kind of a fearsome lady. And those characters he played, I think, were often a tribute to that. But there's a thing about British comedy where I think, you know, getting dressed up in drag is not something that we're kind of worried about. Maybe it all goes back to Shakespeare when men used to play women's parts back in the Elizabethan times. Or even up, I even say with myself, whenever I was doing Cutthroat Kitchen, they would come and say to me, you know, can we dress you up for some of the episodes? And there was one where they dressed me up as, you know, Princess Leia from Star Wars, and I was just like, well, I'm just part of the Python-esque tradition.
Yes, and it was Star Wars, and at least it wasn't Revenge or Return of the Jedi, so I think we're all grateful for that.
I don't think anybody would have wanted to see me do that.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned, yeah, because I knew that his kind of token female character was based on his mom, especially with Life of Brian. But I just heard recently Michael Palin spoke to the press a little bit and said he thought Terry was the best of the drag characters, of the drag players.
Well, they're all very different, I think. I mean, some of them, like John Cleese, it was so obvious it was just John Cleese dressed up.
Whereas yes.
I think Terry Jones put real effort into it. And it was they were a particular type of person, a kind of northern woman. And it comes out of a long tradition of British music hall. There were a lot of people who would play, you know, older women who would, you know, from the north, and that he was in that tradition. There was a comedian called Les Dawson who did it, and he had a whole routine about it, and there was a number of them over the years. And I think he was really touching into that, and I think that's the other side of what he did, is that, you know, he obviously, when Python came out, it was something brand new and very kind of articulate and came out of the Beyond the Fringe and Peter Cook and Dudley Moore kind of school of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But it also had a great affection for the kind of vaudeville or music hall, as they called it in England, that had been going on forever, you know, since the 1800s. And so I think he was kind of very well informed in terms of his comedy, as well as, you know, being quite modern for his day.
Well, I think, and it's funny you mentioned, because I remember one of the first Pythons I encountered is taking that drag concept and moving it a step further. But one of the great early sketches for me is Hell's Grannies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And
they're all on the motorbike,
right.
Beating up.
And you know, yeah. Pension Day is the worst. but the other thing is that you mentioned the vaudeville thing. Of course, is you know, he was allowed to he literally showed his ass on TV with when doing the organ bit.
Oh, absolutely. And that was, you know, you're talking about the late 1960s. You still have I don't know if this term is used in the United States, but we had a term in England called the blue pencil, and it was because the people who looked at the scripts would cross through anything that they didn't like or wasn't appropriate with a blue pencil. So the blue pencil was like it didn't pass the blue pencil test. And, of course, with Python, I don't think anyone quite knew what they were expecting. So when you had him, you know, sitting at the organ, you know, with his kind of top on in a was like a dress suit, and then, you know, naked from the waist down, I think it threw a lot of people. But again, if you think about that in the kind of late 60s, that's pretty extraordinary.
Yes. What was your first encounter with Monty Python and the Flying Circus?
You know, it was as a very young child. I was probably early 70s. I was probably about 6 or 7. And I always remember this show being kind of scheduled, or some my older brother talking about it probably. I'm thinking it was a circus. Yeah, I was. You know, I didn't stay up late, and I probably only started watching it probably in the second series, and then caught up. You know, when they repeated. Obviously, there was no videos or anything in those days, so
right.
They repeated them. And then I remember the time that I got really kind of. I mean, I was a fan of Python, and then particularly in the mid 70s, I became and still am. I still think it's the greatest sitcom ever written. John Cleese did Fawlty Towers.
Yep.
And he only did 14 episodes,
yes.
I think, or maybe less. And I still think it stands up and is still hysterical to these days. And then I went back. He left Python at that point, and I went back then to check out Python. And then all the people around it. So then I began to watch The Ruttles or Rutland Weekend Television, which was another show that Eric Idle did. I began to watch another one of what I think is one of the greats is Ripping Yarns, which Terry Jones and Michael Palin co-wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if a lot of people in the U.S. know that, but what they did is they took a lot of the kind of classic British adventure stories, whether it's Tom Brown's School Days or those kind of things, and they rewrote them like in a very comedy way, but very, very beautifully done with a lot of kind of attention to detail. And they're all on YouTube, I think, or on streaming. It's called Ripping Yarns, and it goes back to the days in the 30s and 40s when they would publish these books with short stories of adventures for boys.
Mm-hmm.
A very British thing. And so I began to really get interested then, and that was when I really discovered in the sense Terry Jones and what he did. What happened then is you began to realize then, you know, going out and seeing the films that they made. And obviously they made their first film wasn't even Holy Grail. They made a kind of collage of their kind of TV shows that they filmed for the U.S. audience.
And now for something completely different.
And that was their first introduction to a lot of people in the U.S., apart from those people. I think it came out of, was it Boston? Or there was one person at PBS somewhere who picked it up and started showing it, and it just caught on. But I still remember, by the time I first came out to the United States in the early 80s, like Python, the two things that everyone knew about kind of British comedy were very different. One was Python and one was Benny Hill.
Yep.
So it was so their view of British comedy. I think was very kind of odd, but you know, the Python was so influential to comedians now. And if you look at a lot of the absurdist comics now, or even you know the surrealist, I still remember. I think it was Stephen Wright or one of those people talking about like this kind of liberation that they got from comedy. It wasn't someone just standing there going, "Have you ever noticed how?"
Yep. Yep.
And the kind of you didn't have to have a closed end to a sketch, or you didn't have to. You know, all of these things have become, you know, and a lot of the improvisational stuff that you're seeing now, a lot of that was kind of, I won't say caused by Python, but certainly kind of liberated by them.
Yeah, here in the States, my father was one of the first ones to buy a VCR in our neighborhood, so we had the giant top-loaded Betamax. And one of the first things we recorded was what PBS would show Holy Grail as a pledge show. And we kept this tape for years, including the pledge breaks. And then, of course, PBS would air Circus usually on like Saturday or Sunday nights. And, yeah, as you said, it was absolutely liberating to see, you know, almost free form of there were no limits. There was no in some cases structure, even though there was. But my wife told me when we were dating, she hated the kids in high school that quoted the boys that quoted Python, and then she wound up marrying one.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I mean quoting Python is still, you know, I can't remember what the reason was fairly recently, but you know it may have been about Macron and Trump or something. It was something crazy, but it was people were quoting the whole scene from, you know, Holy Grail, where they're going, you know, and your father smelled of elderberries,
yeah.
or whatever, and they're all shouting. And and you still people still know that, and it's amazing. Or even when you go and you saw the tributes to Terry, you know, the one thing that everybody's put on there, he wasn't this Messiah. He's a very naughty boy, and it's just so it's so brilliantly done. And they were very just very very clever writers, and I think that's just like I think the original lineup of Saturday Night Live. That really it's lightning in a bottle.
Yep.
And I don't think you'll get others that do amazing things, but I don't think you'll ever get that kind of group because it was about its context in time, Oxford and Cambridge. It was about the rise of satire. Peter Cook had just owned a big club there and brought Lenny Bruce over to England. It was about a change in the way that politics was. Politics wasn't just the elites. It was the rise of socialism in Britain. It was the rise of all kinds of things. And it all people going, you had 1% of people going to university. Suddenly you had people like Michael Palin coming out of grammar school with a scholarship and going to Oxford or go to Cambridge. And so it really was about its time. And I think Python is about its time. And that's why I think some of the later things, The Meaning of Life, which is still 40 years ago, weren't quite as powerful, but even though they were very funny, some of them, because it was about the time and about the context.
Yes. I had a boss at my second newspaper job. This was back in the 90s, and I still give him credit for this, Bob Vavra. But he said that being a member of Python was the comedic equivalent of being a Beatle, and that no matter what these guys did after their after the series, it's always going to be held up to those 5 years, or in the case of John, 4 years of television. And you can still have great you can get into a Hall of Fame as a member of this group and as a solo artist. And I think all six of them are definitely in that, if there was such a thing as a comedic Hall of Fame.
Oh, I'm 100%, and I think I always remember the story of, I think it's George Harrison, when he, and obviously he had a great Python connection.
Yes.
Too, but was producing a film, and I think it was with Madonna and Sean Penn. I can't remember what the film was. But
Shanghai Surprise.
It was a big mistake. And Madonna was being Madonna and a bit of a diva, and she was screaming at someone, I'm Madonna and this and this. And George Harrison walked over and just said, I was in the Beatles, shut up, and she kind of slunk off into a corner. And it was one of those things that you basically, if you were in Python, you top any comic other person. You just go, I was one of Monty Python. And whatever else you do, I think their kind of contribution to comedy was incalculable, I think. Even now, so many things that we do, you'll see that DNA strand. And I'm a great believer with that in cooking. I'm a great believer with it in film. And there's definitely a DNA strand that runs through a lot of comedy now because of them.
And also, for at least for me as well, and I'm sure with others, there was that first encounter with the balance of being really smart and really silly. The only others I can think of at that time, probably Woody Allen and to a certain degree the Marx Brothers. But it wasn't, people didn't think Jerry Lewis was an intellectual. But the guys in Python, the guys who could construct the ladies auxiliary doing the Battle of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Well, it came from a lot of references. Again, like you said, that one, or I still remember, the Communist Quiz Show.
Yes.
Which is one of my, absolute favorites when they're asking them about soccer results and stuff, or, who won the Eurovision Song Contest or something, and they get Castro or Karl Marx answering and getting disappointed that they don't win it. Or, and then just some of it's quite philosophical. The whole, one of the most famous, the argument, and people go through that, but it's brilliantly philosophical. What it is, and I think you've got to, obviously they were extraordinarily educated people, and I've only met a couple of them. I've met Michael Palin again through book things, and a very charming man, very very nice guy, and they just come from a different background. And I think a lot of it then, I think that there was a reaction against, not against them personally, but I think against what that was in the early 80s in Britain. We had the kind of new wave of more radical comedy,
Alexis Sale. We had Rick Mail, who's one of my favorites.
The young ones, yeah.
The young ones, which in many ways was a reaction against that kind of comedy that came out, because you had a lot of the footlights. You had Stephen Fry. You had Hugh Laurie, obviously, who were terrific. I adore them. But
yep.
I think you got a big reaction against that, that kind of strain that came out of Python.
The Alfresco gang.
Yeah, absolutely. So Alfresco, to me, was it was on at the same time as Not the 9 O'Clock News, which was Rowan Atkinson, Mel Smith,
yep.
Griff Rhys-Jones. And that got a huge, obviously got all the coverage. But I think it's a shame because Alfresco, when it worked, and if you look who was in it, you know, Hugh Laurie, Stephen Fry and Emma Thompson, and was incredibly well written and often much funnier than Not the 9 O'Clock News. So I think the strands of comedy, someone actually did, I think it was like Pete Frame, who did Rock Family Trees, actually did a comedy family tree. And it's really fascinating where it goes through who and how they all ended up actually all working together with Ben Elton on Blackadder. Or, you know.
Yeah.
So British comedy, I think, has an amazing history, but a lot of it really stems from the big bang of Python.
Yeah. And MTV in the 80s, I was in middle school, high school, but on Sunday nights they would show Flying Circus, The Young Ones, and then the comic strip. And that was also a great time for a kid with a one in his age to latch on to that comedy. Yeah, and see all these people that have, you know, been huge since, that have boomed on to other things. I wanted to shift gears just a little bit, because I did listen to the Eat My Globe podcast and the jazz podcast that you were a part of. I guess my first thing was I loved hearing you make comparisons to the Kitchen to a jazz band as well as a leadership. I appreciate that. And what do you listen to when you're cooking?
Well, right now, actually, I'm a real kind of podcast enthusiast. So I tend to use it as an opportunity to catch up with sometimes with news, although right now I'm so kind of weary of everything going on that a lot of the things that I might listen to, whether it's Pod Save America or things, you know, I'm of a more liberal disposition. So I kind of don't listen as much because I just get worn out. So I listen to a lot of film podcasts. So my two favorite right now, there's a very famous, I think it's the biggest film magazine in the world right now called Empire in England.
Yep.
And they do a podcast. It's a little... The folks are a little young and enthusiastic sometimes and have a particular kind of predilection for Marvel and stuff like that. But actually, they're very good reviewers and they cover films and do really long interviews. My kind of favorite one that I've been listening to for years, and I think he's one of the great film critics, is a guy in England called Mark Kermode, K-E-R-M-O-D-E. And he does one with Simon Mayo, which has been on the BBC forever. He's a very... quite an intellectual, a very intellectual critic, but very open. He's and it's on the BBC, a great documentary with William Friedkin on Exorcist. He's considered like the expert on The Exorcist, and he's a big fan of horror, and he does a lot of films called Secret Cinema on. So it's called The Kermode and Mayo on Film or something on the BBC.
Okay.
And then, I just have some that I listen to a lot of history because that's my passion. So there's one called Noble Rot right now, which is about the history of certain royal families and sometimes the more gruesome histories of some of the people in the aristocratic world. And then my favorite probably of all is one on the BBC that's been going for a long, long time called In Our Time. And they cover all kinds of subjects. So in the last few weeks, it's been the Siege of Paris. They've done the nature of solar winds. They've done the number zero. They've done the philosophy of, I think it was Nietzsche. I mean, it's hundreds of episodes, and they bring in experts who talk about it in quite an academic way. But that's one of the ones that inspired me to do my own food history podcast, the Eat My Globe one, which has done rather well, which is thrilling.
Mm-hmm. I just heard your chat with Alton Brown. So, folks, if you get a chance, go to Eat My Globe and find the podcast. You did a thing on the unsung heroes of the food world. And I will ask you, have you seen the film The Road to Wellville?
I have, yes.
So, since one of the subject matters is brought up in that film, and you know, as funny as Alan Parker can make yogurt enemas and Anthony Hopkins with buck teeth, that's about it.
Yeah, I mean it is. Yeah, that was a great episode. Apart from the fact it's just Alton, and I could have just turned the microphone on and left the room, but he still would have kept everyone entertained for an hour.
Yep,
he's a good pal. And so that was a real kind of I had a lot of nice responses to that. And I think people got that it was just two friends, which we are, just chatting. And so I think that was one of my favorites. We did one on the history of Escoffier, the great chef who kind of informed just about everything that happens now, particularly the kind of French style kitchen. And I'm just writing the new season. It takes a while. It's about each season is almost the equivalent of writing a book, so I have to fit that in amongst everything else that I'm doing. And so that won't come out till the middle of the year, but I've just written the first episode on the history of garlic, which is really fascinating.
Nice.
Because of its history through ancient Egypt, through where it was used as a medicine, it was used obviously for food, and then it was used to ward off evil spirits. We even think now, vampires and all of that, if you've seen, your Dracula movies. There's a genuine, real history to it, which I love.
And I know when you hit Alton with the questions, and one of the things that he, at the end, he answered one of his dream meals is dinner with Orson Welles in the 1970s. I would counter that by saying dinner with Sophia Loren anytime, but especially 1960.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people would want to be at that dinner. the one person who I would have loved to have sat with and had dinner, I met him once very briefly, but was David Niven. David Niven's stories, and one of the reasons why I think even now I have a passion for films from that period, and I say period because obviously he was around a long time, but particularly the 30s, 40s, 50s, was flying to India one time in the 70s. There was no movies or anything. I was with the family, and my parents bought me a copy of The Moon's a Balloon and Bring on the Empty Horses, and I read them on this flight because it was a long old flight. And I just became entranced with Hollywood of that period. And you are talking about, we talk about stars now. I don't think it even compares. Sophia Loren would definitely fit into that. These real, movie gods, the Cary Grants, the Clark Gables, mm-hmm. the Rita Hayworth, David Niven, Errol Flynn, Spencer Tracy. And I think they don't, we kind of forget how good their films were as well, because some of the styles are different. And obviously, it's interesting, obviously, how film styles change so much. When I go and see, I haven't seen it yet, Parasite, but what I've seen, the style of that, and you go back even 5 years, or you look at a Marvel movie now and in 2008, the first Iron Man, they're so different in styles. That often it can be a bit discordant. It's about like reading Dickens, it can be really hard on you if you're not used to the language. And so some of those films, but if you go back and watch probably my favorite film, A Matter of Life and Death, or you go and watch, I'm talking particularly about Powell and Pressburger, but you talk about The Red Shoes or something, they're just magnificent. I don't think we would be able to make films like that now. I think they just have such intensity. But that's not to say that we don't make great films now. I've just been trying to put a list together of some of my favorites for someone. But I just have a passion for films from that period.
Mm-hmm. Now, the last time we talked, you talked about having a Sunday film ritual growing up. Are you still able to do that at home whenever possible?
I do. It's hard to get hold of those films. I remember talking about the Ealing comedies, which I think, again, are wonderful to watch. Kind Hearts and Coronets, Whiskey Galore. They're just, you know, they're just wonderful. Man in the White Suit with Alec Guinness. I mean, if you ever get a chance, if you haven't seen them, or if people listening haven't seen them, just go and seek them out. They're wonderful, wonderful films. I try and do that now, but what I'm trying to do now is try and look at films from the 60s and 70s that, you know, have been forgotten a bit. I'm just watching. I haven't finished it. I started watching The Boys from Brazil the other day just because I haven't seen it. And it's Olivier and it's
Gregory Peck.
It's Gregory Peck, and it's so different, and it's a little clunky in places, but still really, really interesting. The great adventure film. So to sit down and watch, you know, The Great Escape, or to watch A Bridge Too Far, or, I mean, those are just, these are all war-related. That's just, they happen to be, but to go and sit down and watch some of those films, I think, is really fantastic. And then some of the films I watched growing up, you know, in the 80s, the ones that first dragged me to the cinema. And sometimes you just go, I have no idea why I stood in line to go and see, you know, Porky's or something. But it was a huge film of its time.
Yep.
It's harder for me to go to the cinema now because it's just become so noisy. It's become, it's an experience that I enjoy less than I ever used to. So what my wife and I tend to do, and we can do it being a freelancer, is it where I can go off and we go to the early morning screening of something.
Yep.
And then a lot of it is, I spend so much time in the air that I end up catching a lot of films on planes. And that's harder when you're watching a big blockbuster, obviously. You want to see that in the big screen. But if it's a small, intimate film, I don't think it matters too much. I think that's... I was going to say, my film of last year, I thought the best film I saw was Booksmart. I just thought it was fantastic.
I said it's the best John Hughes film not written or directed by John Hughes. Yeah, I thought my daughter's 18, and I've told her that I'm not the biggest John Hughes fan, even though I was the audience base in the 80s, but that film and Eighth Grade and Edge of 17 and Lady Bird, I will take those after anything that was done in the 80s any day of the week.
Well, I think that's when I say that Booksmart is as good as any of that style of film. That I've seen in many years. The key performances were absolutely terrific. It was funny. It was gracious. It was, you know, it was. I just really, yeah. I was on the plane and I was laughing a great deal at that. And so, I think that's mine. But I think this year is going to be hopefully an amazing one. And the other film that I saw, which I actually again saw, which is not one I think got any coverage over here, and it was Marc Kermode's film of the decade, and that, which is why I sought it out. And it's called Bait, and I don't know if you know this. So this is a film that was made by a guy I think called Mark Richards, but I may have got his name wrong, who's a Cornish film director. He films on celluloid using 16 millimeter. He films without soundtrack and then overdubs the soundtrack. And the cameras are like these hand-wound cameras. And he made this film about the kind of division in a Cornish fishing village where basically the fishing industry is dying off and the rest of the village is being sold off to people using it as a second home because it's a beautiful part of England. And this film is just incredible. And it has a real kind of texture to it because of the way that they filmed it. You could go and have a look at the trailer. It will show you everything you need to know. But that was one of the great films. And again, it's just showing this amazing filmmaking being done right now.
It's called Bait?
Bait, as in okay. baiting for fish.
Okay. My top film from last year was the Aretha Franklin concert documentary, Amazing Grace. I mean, that's as old, you know, you can say what you will about technology and what it did for Marvel and all that stuff. But the fact that technology had caught up and they were able to sync that film, and I'm an old concert film guy from, you know, Woodstock to The Last Waltz, and just an amazing lightning in a bottle, kind of guerrilla filmmaking. Just, you know, even seeing Sydney Pollack point to other cameras, and her at the top of her vocal game.
It was. I mean, the technology of that, the fact that when Pollock did it, he didn't put any of the sequencing in, so no one had been able to put it together at all. And then what I loved is, it's when you see her walk in and start singing, and you know, I've seen the film again. I saw it on a plane, and you're just entranced by her. By her singing. So, I mean, and she is. I still remember with Aretha Franklin, we many years ago when I was in publishing, we put we published a book with Ertegun.
Ahmet Ertegun, yeah.
Ahmet Ertegun. And it was called What Did I Say? I can't remember the exact name of it. It was like a biography, but with pictures and of his life. And he talked about... in the interviews, he talked about meeting Aretha Franklin and going to meet her father. And obviously, she came from a very church background and had never sung outside of the church, really. And so they were really worried that he was going to take her off into this rather wild world of, you know, blues or whatever, where, you know, that was a lot different from church. And the reason they let her go is the father said to him, where are you going to take her? And he said, back to church. And the first album she did were gospel albums. And they kind of reassured her, them that, you know, this is who she was. And I was lucky enough to see her sing. And if you go online again, there's one concert she did towards the end of her life where she sang for Barack Obama.
Yep.
And she never lost it. Lost that voice. It was, and you could watch Obama and everybody else in the audience is just, you know, goggle-eyed at this amazing voice that, you know, it's like God-given. I mean, when you see it, you know, and you hear it for the first time, it's something very, very, very special.
Indeed. I want to wrap things up because I know you have plans, but you mentioned how long have you been married?
We're coming up for our 10th anniversary, and my 10th anniversary of moving to the United States.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What was the first film that you showed your wife that just landed like a lead balloon?
Oh, my gosh. You know, the one that I think probably a lot of people watch and they don't necessarily get, which I still watch it every year, is Spinal Tap. And I think it's because a lot of the references, if you don't know, you know, I grew up in the late 70s, early 80s in Yorkshire, which was the Sheffield, you know, new wave of British heavy metal, Saxon, and Def Leppard. I followed, you know, Judas Priest or went to see Led Zeppelin. There are so many references in there to certain people and so many great lines in that film that it's another one where you've become, you know, it's boring if you quote it too much, like Take It Up to 11 or Lukewarm Water. I even saw someone talking about that with politics recently. I'm the lukewarm water. And everyone who knows that knows it, but I'm not sure that it was a favorite. So that would probably be it.
I showed it to my daughter who had seen she had seen Christopher Guest's films. This was, of course, a Rob Reiner film. But, yeah, she could not latch on to that. My senior year of college, I got to see Spinal Tap perform live.
Oh, wow.
They did a tour. It was their album Break Like the Wind. And of course. And they opened with Tonight, I'm Gonna Rock You Tonight. And they were lowered from the top of the theater. And of course, Harry Shearer is stuck halfway through and plays in the air for the rest of the song. They, of course, had Stonehenge, but it was delivered in a UPS bag and put on the stage. And Chris Guest did his guitar. He did a solo, but he also juggled and threw balls at the guitars on the stands at the same time.
I mean, there are still so many lines in that. Every time I watch it, I'll hear another line. I remember I watched it when they meet Duke Storm in the
Duke Fame
in the lobby.
Yeah,
And they, you know, it's when they go, this much talent, or he was so bad, they were still booing him when he came on. It's all that. But there's a line, which is just the throwaway line by his manager, and I'd never heard it before. He goes, I'd love to talk to you, but we have to go and sit in the lobby and wait for the limo.
Yeah.
And I'd never heard it. You know, I'd seen the film, I've probably seen it 100 times, but there's always a line in there every time that I go, I'd never heard that before. And so I think that's a film that just keeps on giving.
The first few years of this actual show, I would use, there's a fine line between stupid and clever. That's how I sum up film sociology. And it's true, really.
Yeah. Well, he's brilliant in that. Was it when they says the audience didn't get smaller, it just got more selective?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, I mean, all the way through it, you know, there's stuff in there. And, I mean, you know, so I still love that film, but I think it's not a family film for me.
No, Mrs. Soucy said, uses the term made by boys for boys. And Tap is probably like that.
Yes, very much.
Well, Simon, I really, really appreciate your time and for you sharing your stories of Terry Jones. And I would love to have you on again fairly soon. And I hope that your next Sunday movie are Burgers and Anything by Ken Russell.
Well, Ken Russell, of course. I mean, maybe I'll watch Listomania.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, now you've got me going.
Now
Roger Daltrey, I think.
Yes, where he's riding a giant phallus and Wagner is Hitler. And yeah, I own most of Ken Russell's films and not for the faint of heart.
very definitely not for the faint of heart, but definitely, definitely a unique voice in cinema history.
Well, and he was one of those that whether it soared or it crashed, it was all on him. It wasn't focus groups. It wasn't producers tinkering with it. Yep. It was kind of as is.
Definitely, definitely. Well, it's good to have those people around. You need people like him or like Herzog who are just they just do their stuff.
Yep. So, folks, go check out the Eat My Globe podcast and Simon's on social media. And Simon, thank you so much for your time.
It's very much my pleasure.
And Simon Majumder, you can go to eatmyglobe.com to hear his podcast. He also has his own website, Simon Majumder. It's SimonMajumdar.com for all the information on Simon and really, really good guy. I could have him on every other week if possible, if he'd let me. No, he's not. Anyway, with that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. I want to end this week's film sociology with some audio from Terry Jones and of course, the closing words because I like sharing audio with you folks. So anyway, thanks for listening. We'll check you out next week. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. Here's Terry Jones. Salute to you, friend.
If there's ever going to be any progress...
Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here. Oh, how'd you do?
How do you do, good lady? I'm Arthur, King of the Britons. Whose castle is that?
King of the who?
The Britons.
Who are the Britons?
Well, we all are. We are all Britons. And I am your king.
Oh, didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
You're fooling yourself. We're living in a dictatorship. A self-perpetuating autocracy in which the working classes...
Oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
That's what it's all about. If only people would...
Please, good people. I am in haste. Who lives in that castle?
No one lives there.
Then who is your lord?
We don't have a lord.
What?
I told you, we're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Order? Who does he think he is?
I'm your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
You don't vote for kings.
Well, how'd you become king, then? Who are you?
We are three wise men.
What?
We are three wise men.
Well, what are you doing creeping out of cash 2 o'clock in the morning? That doesn't sound very wise to me.
We are astrologers. We have come from the east.
Is this some kind of joke?
We wish to praise the infant. We must pay homage to him.
Homage? You're all drunk. It's disgusting. Out, come on, out. No. Bursting in here with tales about oriental fortune. fortune tellers. Come on out.
No, no, we must see him.
Go and pray someone else's back. Go on.
We were led by a star.
Led by a bottle of all light. Go on out.
Well, we must see him. We have brought presents.
Out.
Gold, frankincense, myrrh.
Well, why didn't you say he's over there? Sorry, the place is a bit of a mess. Well, what is myrrh anyway?
It is a valuable balm.
A balm? What are you giving him a balm for? It might bite him.
What?
That's a dangerous animal. Quick, throw it in the trough.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. It's great.
No, it is an ointment.
Well, there is an animal called a balm. Or did I dream it? So you're astrologers, are you? Well, what is he then?
Hmm?
What star sign is he?
Capricorn.
Capricorn, eh? What are they like?
He is the son of God, our Messiah, king of the Jews.
That's Capricorn, is it?
No, that's just him.
Oh, I was going to say, otherwise there'd be a lot of them.
By what name are you calling him?
O'Brien.
We worship you, O'Brien, who are Lord over us all. Praise unto you, Brian, and to the Lord our Father. Amen.
You do a lot of this, then?
What?
This praising.
No.
If you drop in by again, do pop in. And thanks a lot for the gold and frankincense. But don't worry too much about the myrrh next time, all right? Thank you. Goodbye. Well, weren't they nice?
Out of their bloody minds, but still.
Look at that. Here, that's fine. Hey, you forgave me that. Oh.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!